Good evening, everybody. I'm David Deering from 1070 The Fan. We are live downtown Monument Circle, MS Worldwide headquarters, and welcome to the talk of Gasoline Alley. And Donald Davidson, the historian from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, is here with us tonight. Donald, it's good to see you. It's an honor for me to be here with you tonight.
Thank you, David. Very good.
Yesterday we had a caller calling a little bit too late. You were talking about the 77 race, mm-hmm. and Brandon from Indianapolis. Brandon, you have an interesting story for Donald.
Yeah. Hey, Donald. Brandon Weddle. My grandfather was Phil Headback.
I'll be darned.
And I wasn't planning on being in my car and listening to the radio broadcast.
Uh-huh.
And I had, in fact, talked about literally 20 minutes before I heard his name said by you to on the phone about my grandfather was the owner, you know, the Bryant Heating and Cooling and Janet Guthrie, and then all of a sudden you're talking about it.
Oh.
and the emotion that came over me was overwhelming. And so I felt compelled to call. I spoke to my uncle, Jim Headback, who he said, you guys have been friends for a number of years.
Absolutely. So your dad is Steve then?
My dad is not a Headback. My mother, Susie Headback.
Then. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Susie Headback was one of the three kids of Phil and Betty. And I just wanted to call in and say thank you so much for that.
Oh, well, you're welcome. I remember very well. And but Phil, I knew very, very well. I met him in 64. And then it ended up, I did some commercials for, two or three years, I think. I did TV commercials right in the mid-70s. So at the time that Janet Guthrie was driving for them, I was doing radio and TV commercials for your grandfather. And he was a lot of fun, a real enthusiast, and a great promoter.
Oh, yeah. In 77, I was 5 years old, so I didn't really know what was going on. But as I learned about the history of him and the family and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and, you know, I think about the silver dollars that he would give the drivers. I would like you to speak to that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny. We must have ESP or something, because I was thinking about that while you were talking. What a great promotion that was. And in 1950, when it appeared that Parnelli Jones or somebody was going to do 150 miles an hour, Phil Headback had this, and he wore a policeman's hat at that time, because they had his sponsorship was Bobby Marshman. Was Ebe Hoover was the owner, but it's called the Bryant Heating and Cooling Special. And at that time, Car 54, Where Are You, was on Channel 6, and that was the catchphrase that everybody was, you know, you'd hear that on the streets all the time. And so he had this idea, I wonder, could we get number 54? And then that would be funny, because we'd be number 54, and everybody's saying, Car 54, where are you? So he went to USAC, and yes, it was available. So he said, well, you know, Bobby Marshman gets a good number that he's entitled to, but we want to use 54. So we did that. And then he went to Channel 6 and talked to the PR people there and said, wouldn't it be great if we could get the, you know, Tootie and Muldoon, I think, were the name of the two officers, and Joe Flynn and, painted myself in a corner. But anyway, they came in, and I know that Phil Headback is wearing like a policeman's cap when he's doing the silver dollars with Parnelli Jones, and they had this bucket with 150 silver dollars in it. And so he's not part of that team, but he knew how to get publicity. And so he just had Parnelli turn his helmet upside down, and then he pours all the silver dollars into the helmet. I think Parnelli still has most of those or some.
I don't blame him.
But then in 77, Tom Sneva did 200 miles an hour. He did not have a 200 mile an hour four lap average, but he did two laps above 200 miles an hour. So Phil Headback was back with a bucket with the 200, And then they had the idea, it looks like Janet Guthrie's going to qualify for us, Brian Heating and Cooling, a headback sponsored car for Roll of Allstead. And so they decided, let's do one for Janet, and we'll give her enough silver dollars to match her qualifying speed. And so what they did was they put 200 silver dollars in with the idea that they would simply take out what they needed to take out to match the speed. And so when she did 188 mile an hour qualifying average, then they just took out the 12 silver dollars. But Phil Headback was great for getting publicity. He knew how to get the picture in the paper. And one of the things was to be the first car on the track. He realized that because, and I was listening to Kevin Lee and Kurt Cavan coming down here talking about the way that the entries used to go out early and they'd be coming in all spring. You know, you would just wait for it. You'd watch the news and listen to the radio and watch the newspaper because it would say, you know, six more cars were entered today and five more cars. And that would go on. You know, there would probably be 20, 25 releases in a in a 3-4 month period. So Phil Headback, one of his, he thought, if we could get the first entry, that'll be a great story. And so the entries would go out over the holidays usually. And January the 2nd, he'd be at the Speedway office standing on the door ready to hand in an entry so they'd have the first entry. And then the next thing was to be first on the track. And they did that several times. And then, of course, you know, then he wanted to be the first to qualify, try to win the pole and the race and so on and so forth. But he was just a great enthusiast. And the point I was making last night was all those years up through about 77 when Janet came in, 78, all of the Bryant Heating and Cooling specials before that were not the factory. They were Phil Headback doing it on his own. And I know that I've talked to people that were on the crew. In those days, you didn't have show cars. I mean, you had the race car, and most people had one. The more affluent teams had two, and of course they had one. But Phil Headback was great for, he wanted to display the car at shopping malls and everything. And so the crew were always, you know, grumbling because practice was over at 6 o'clock and then they had to load the car up.
They had to put in overtime.
Yeah, because Phil Headback said, we're going to have the car down at Greenwood Shopping Center or something and no show car. They'd have to roll the real one. When the kids would and the adults would go to the malls or wherever it was to see this car, that was the actual one that you know, Bobby Marshman was going to drive,
awesome.
Or Sachs, or Len Sutton, whoever else it was.
Sounds like one of the great early promoters then.
Absolutely, yes. And I remember him very fondly, and he was very, very good to me. And, you know, they did a couple of promotional things. There was a thing called the Bryant Trivia Wheel. I thought about that. We did that 2 years in a row, and the listeners will either know what that is or don't worry about it. And then I think I wrote some articles and then did the TV commercials and would make appearances for him, and it was just a wonderful relationship.
Well, that's awesome. Hey, Brandon, thank you so much for calling back in. When one caller leaves, that means you know that another line is open. Let's go up next to Mike in Vernon Hills. Mike, you're on with Donald. How are you doing, sir?
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm fine. This is not about Gene Simmons, is it?
No.
Oh, good.
David, congratulations for being in the big chair tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, Donald, I recently read the book, Damn Few Died in Bed. The Dunlop story, and one of the things that struck me is how casual he was about getting a driver in his car, especially at Indianapolis. He would show up without a driver. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Andy Dunlop, the Central Excavating team, and the casualness of teams showing up without drivers.
Well, they weren't the only ones. It's funny. Somebody, in fact, didn't somebody ask me that up in Chicago when you were in the audience? So I've already answered this one with you in the audience, I think, or maybe I didn't do a very good job of it there. But first of all, Andy Dunlop was the chief mechanic for the Central Excavating team. The owner was Pete Salemi from Cleveland, Ohio. And Central Excavating, Pete Salemi didn't have to go out and find a sponsor because he was Central Excavating. And that was the sponsor for oh golly, from starting from 52 or 51 rather, which was their first entry, and that went all the way through till then they started to get sponsors, and in fact in 1961, by which time it was the S&R Racing Enterprises Special. Pete Salemi had a partner, Nick Rinney, and so they actually had qualified in 1961, and Brian Heating and Cooling came into that one. They'd missed the show with the team that they came with, which was the Mary George team, with Elma George and then Paul Russo driving, and they ended up not making it. And so Phil then put the Bryant Heating and Cooling sponsorship on the Salemi car. But anyway, the drivers, it was 1951, they had Bill Vukovich, and I'll, for a moment here, I'll just concentrate on Indianapolis 500 only. I never know quite what to do about that. Sometimes I mention the other events and sometimes I don't. And then I think later, you know, like for instance, when I was talking about Bobby Marshman the other night, I should have spent more time talking about his accomplishments at other tracks, but we had to keep on moving. But Bill Vukovich in 1951, and then 52 was Eddie Johnson. 53, they missed the show with, let's see, Johnny Fredericks and Len Duncan. 54, Chuck Wyant making a qualifying attempt and didn't make it. Then 55, they were back in the show with Shorty Templeman. In 56, they had two cars, and it was Gene Hartley and Eddie Johnson, and they both were running at the end, finishing 11th and 15th. And then Chuck Wyant in 57. And 58, it didn't make it. It was Len Sutton got out of the car, and then Jimmy Daywalt made a qualifying attempt, and they didn't make it. And then 59, they didn't make it with Shorty Templeman and a bunch of drivers, which kind of figures into your point about how casual they were about drivers in those days. And then in 60, they had a Watson Roadster, and Len Sutton, and most of the times these cars did not finish. They were just very solid, regular, passionate teams that would come back year after year, year after year, and if things didn't work out so well, you know, they'd be at the next race. The best finish that a Pete Salemi car had was 1965 with a rear engine car, a Gerhardt, that Mickey Rupp drove, and Mickey Rupp was a relative of A.J. Watson somehow, that I'm a little hazy on, but he had he actually had a dart, the dart cart go-kart business was Mickey Rupp's. Anyway, they qualified, and as the Central Excavating Special. And G.C. Murphy Stores were a new sponsor at that time, and they were with a team that hadn't made it. And so sponsorship was transferred over, and so the car ran on race day as the G.C. Murphy Store Special and finished sixth. And they ran for a couple more years after that. But I think that the point that Mike wanted to make was that not only did cars often would be entered with no driver, because they just didn't know. They figured, we'll get the best one that we can. And then by the same token, drivers would show up and it was known as pounding the pavement. And it was a whole game that they played. But it was, you still got people looking for rides. But now it's so much about money. And we don't want to belabor that. But back then, the drivers didn't bring money. They just bought themselves, and so they would just walk around the garage area, they didn't want to visit the garages too often to become a nuisance, but they also just wanted people to know that they were there. Mm-hmm. And as the month wore on, drivers would be hopping in and out of cars. Some of the teams would start thinking, golly, you know, the guy we came with, we're going to have to make a change here. And they'd say, look, we're going to try somebody else. Maybe somebody would take a few laps and come and say, why don't you make some changes? And that would work. The original driver then would be okay. Or sometimes maybe they would just drivers would try other cars, and other people would try theirs, and it was just this like a musical chairs thing going on, and then you would end up with combinations where people would qualify a car that somebody else couldn't qualify, and the guy that couldn't qualify that would get in and qualify something else. There's another portion of this, but I think probably we need to take a break
here. Mike, thank you for calling, buddy. We'll hit a break here. We'll be right back with the Talk Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan. We are here with the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson. Donald, you had some final thoughts from Mike's call.
Yeah, just to finish up on that, the kind of things that would happen in those days, Trenton, there was a 100-mile race at Trenton, which was the race before Indianapolis, 1958, and Len Sutton won the race. That was his first championship race. They went to Indianapolis, and Len started out of the car and then got out of it. And as I said earlier, Jimmy Daywalt got in, tried to qualify, and it missed the show. Well, evidently they'd come to a parting of the ways. So when they went to Milwaukee for the 100-miler, they looked for another driver, and they got Art Bish, who had driven at Indianapolis and was involved in the first lap accident. So he'd finished 33rd and never completed a lap. Anyway, so he goes up to Milwaukee with the Central Excavating car, won the pole and the race. And so we're not talking about backup cars and you go into the shop and there's six cars that the driver can choose from. They had one car. Or they say that they had a dirt car and a roadster. So the same car, the dirt car, won at Trenton with Len Sutton, and then the next race at Milwaukee with Art Bish. But I think Mike's point was that it was not unusual at all for somebody to go to a championship race to take a car and not have a driver. And all of the races in those days were one-day affairs. I mean, you got there on the morning of the race, practice for 30 minutes, qualify, and then line up for the feature, and the cars that missed the show would load up and start leaving. And so it was not unusual at all. I mean, Bobby Grimm finished second in a race at Trenton, and Bud Tinkelstad one time. They weren't even the program because they just showed up there and then picked up a ride while they were there. There was a bunch more. Spider Webb at Syracuse and Detroit in 1949 subbed for an injured driver and won the pole for both races and finished second in one and third in the other. That's a whole nother thing. Syracuse, New York on Saturday, Detroit, Michigan on Sunday, 1949. No freeways. They would actually tow up through. They go through Canada on two-lane roads and then come down through to Windsor to get to Detroit. Anyway, so whole other thing about how tough it used to be. But this used to be a regular thing, and I started thinking just a few years ago, because in my days at USAC, and I'll be done here in just a moment, my days at USAC, drivers were always coming into the office to look for especially sprints and midgets, but championship occasionally, and they say, oh, can I see the entries for Terre Haute, or can I see the entries for Winchester, because they were looking to see if there was anybody that didn't have a driver, and then they'd call the car owner and say, can I drive for you on Sunday? The other thing was to just show up. And so I'm thinking, nobody does this anymore, but it wasn't unusual at all. You'd see a bunch of drivers would get to the track and they'd sign what was known as the open sheet and then wait for the owners to arrive. And an owner, by the same token, maybe he'd come to parting of ways with somebody and he said, okay, well, I'll go to Winchester. I don't know who I'm going to get, but I'll just when I get there, I'll just see who's available. And it wasn't about money. It was just pick the best driver or who they thought was the best driver that would be available.
It's just crazy to think, because there's no way a team owner now would go to a track without a driver, especially with all the money that's involved now. So that's just crazy how 50, 60
totally
years ago.
Different. Yeah. Even when somebody, like during the month, we don't know what may happen, where there might be a change of driver and somebody, a ride may be available and somebody gets in. Well, it's not a last minute thing. I mean, it's been negotiations were in place for weeks and months, and It's like that now. I wish it wasn't, but what are you going to do about it? That's the way it is. I just preferred it the way that it was. Is it like that now? No, but, you know, we just keep on going.
317-239-1070. We do have an open line, but Chris from Baltimore. Chris, you're up with Donald Davidson. How are you, Chris?
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Donald. I was curious if you could profile Freddie Agabation for me.
Freddie Agabation, I would be delighted. There's what an amazing guy he was. He never had a really top finish. His fourth in 1953 was his best finish in the 500 with Paul Russo as a relief driver, but he was an excellent qualifier. He was in the middle of the front row in 1950. There's a story there. And then he was on the pole in 52 with the Cummins diesel and the middle of the front row in 1953. So 3 out of 4 years he was on the front row. He won a championship race at Sacramento in 1949, but he was probably he was one of the sort of the steady veterans, and he was very articulate, had this amazing voice, very articulate, and very much of an engineer type. And so he was an ideal test driver. And I don't know how many cars that he would drive during the month, because he would normally be with a fairly decent operation and be up to speed and ready to go early on. And then people would say, you know, could you take a ride in our car? And so, I mean, he would get into all kinds of different types of cars and then just make suggestions as to what changes might be made. And there's this great story about Walt Faulkner in 1950 as a rookie. And a diminutive fellow, I think Faulkner stood like 5'6 or something like that, 5'6, 5'7. And with a dirt car, he won the pole just as qualifying was ending on the first day in 1950. It was a sensational because it's 1 and 4 lap track records. And it knocked with a dirt car. And it knocked Agabation off the pole. But more than that, during the afternoon, and Agabation told me this in the Champions Spark Plug room one day, and he said, I actually took that car out because I drove for Agageni. I'd won Sacramento in 49. And so they came to me and said, hey, you know, would you take a ride in this thing? And so he said, I took it out and ran a few laps, made some suggestions, and then Faulkner, and he'd already qualified himself, and now he's driving for another team to help him out. And then he said, Faulkner went out, ran some laps, Agabation timed when he said to Aggie, he said, I think he's ready to go, put the kid in line. And so it knocked him off the pole. And, you know, did he mind? No, because, I mean, there was not really much monetary value to winning the pole in those days.
There was no pole reward or anything?
No, not really. No, if there was anything, it wasn't very, very much. But
was it more of a prestige thing?
Yes. Yes. But it you know, and they made a big deal about the pole and the front row qualifying shots with all three and all that kind of stuff, but you know, it wasn't you weren't devastated if you lost it. But anyway, so he just chuckled about that. But anyway, in addition to having this mechanical knowledge and the ability to talk to the mechanics and speak in their language, he had this incredible voice and really raspy voice. And so when he retired it was November of 58 is when he said that's retirement. Sid Collins thought this guy would be great because they'd gone and done talks together. He thought he would be ideal for a driver analyst. And so Fred Agabation was the analyst for the next many years. And when I showed up in 1964, Fred Agabation was one of the first people I met. In fact, I was interviewed on the PA on the Sunday afternoon, the second qualifying day, which I hadn't been at the track 48 hours yet. And I was interviewed by Jim Phillippe, and I did Fred Agabation's record. And there's photographs to authenticate that. But then Fred did a little nightly show, 15 minutes on Channel 6. I mean, everybody had, you know, Today at the Track and all this kind of stuff, radio and TV. And he did a little radio show for what was then WFBM. They had a little reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I did an interview with them there, and I've still got that somewhere. But anyway, then what I did not know was when I was a guest in the booth in the 1964 race for just a couple of minutes, I came on about two-thirds of the way through the race, said, come on up during the race and we'll put you on the air and, you know, tell your folks in England that you'll be on. So what I did not know for many, many, many years, I heard that excerpt, but what I didn't hear was what followed it. And years later, I learned then that Sid and Fred Agabation talked about me after I had gone. Well, in 65, I came back, and then I was in the booth with the both of them for those years. And it was an honor to induct Sid Collins into two different halls of fame and Freddie Agabation into the Auto Racing Hall of Fame that's headquartered at the Speedway. And Joanna, the daughter, could not come, and so she asked if I would accept on his behalf, and I did that. And I just wind up with this, tell Agabation stories forever, what a great guy he was. But anyway, she told me, the daughter, she said, Fred Jr. is an airline pilot, and she said he has the same voice. And so she said that when he comes on the speaker and said, good morning, everybody, this is Captain Fred Agabation. You know, they're old-time race fans come down and say, is that? Yes, that's the son. And I've never met him. But anyway, apparently, and I don't even know if he's still flying now, because it was several years ago when she told me this, but he still had the same voice like Fred Agabation did. But anyway, bless Fred Agabation for being such a great guy. And I mean, that's sort of like a personal thing. But I heard that voice back in England before I was able to come over here, and then to meet him, and what a wonderful man he was. It was just a pleasure to, year after year, when he would come back, and whether it was in the champion room or whatever it was, what a great storyteller, and one of my favorite people of all time. So thank you for calling in and asking about Fred.
Thank you, Chris. You know, you mentioned that interview you had up in the booth in 64.
Yeah.
I was digging through YouTube a few days ago just trying to find some stuff for intros for Trackside.
Uh-huh.
I think I found that interview.
Okay, it's about two-thirds of the way through the race. And
was that your first Indy 500, was 64?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I saw that on YouTube. I'll have to go dig for that after the show. But if that's the case, we'll tweet it out. But that's pretty awesome. Well, hey, thank you. Thank you again, Chris. And we got another break here. We'll be right back with Donald Davidson on the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Welcome back. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering, normally on the other side of the board where Joey Molinaro is. Joey, thank you for hanging in there tonight. We appreciate it. Donald Davidson is here with me, downtown Monument Circle. And Donald, you got to do something pretty special today with Tony Stewart's mom?
I did. I've been doing all these nostalgic things. We talked on the first night about the fact that Rushville Race Night is back after, for the first time in 20 years, I was down there, and it was just like old times. Among the guests, I did Mark Dismore, Tom Bigelow, but then Johnny Parsons and Tony Stewart.
Oh, wow.
And that was on last Thursday. So then today, for Johnny Parsons' sister, Joni Boyles, there was a fundraiser for the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And
oh, okay.
It was at what is now Brickyard Crossing, but it's still the Speedway Motel, and nothing much has been going on there for a while, and now it looks like they're up and running again. So I did an event this lunchtime, and I think there was like probably four men, I think, and about 100 women. And all the women were all dressed up in black and white checks outfits. And I moderated. It was going to be Beth Bowles, who's Connor Daly's mother and Doug's wife. And then she had to bow out at the last minute because her next son, Connor's younger brother, was some kind of a scholastic, I forget now, I think it was a sporting event or something, but anyway, it was something that she had to go to, they had to go to. So, and I didn't explain that very well. So it ended up that I did this panel discussion with Joni Voiles, whose dad was Johnny Parsons, who won the race in 1950. Our brother is Johnny Parsons, that drove in the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s. And then also Poncho Carter is her brother.
There you go.
Because Dwayne Carter was her stepfather, and I knew both Dwayne and Johnny extremely well. I'd rather go into all that. And then we had Wanda Devon, the former Wanda Unser, who was Little Al's mom. And then Pam, who's Tony Stewart's mom. And so we just had a great time with, basically women in racing, but all of the people that they interacted with, because Joni is fascinating because she grew up in Speedway and, used to babysit for, drivers' kids. And she told all kinds of stories about the people that she grew up with. So I really, really enjoyed that. I mean, it was so nostalgic to be back into what still is the Speedway Motel to me in the dining room where I met so many people and spent so much time over the years. And to just do this this panel discussion with three of my favorite people. So, thank you for asking about that.
Oh, absolutely. That sounds awesome.
On Thursday, I'm with Johnny Parsons and Tony Stewart and Tony's dad. And then today, I'm with Johnny Parsons' sister and Tony's mom.
So you've knocked out the whole Stewart family.
Yeah,
they're good.
We're good with the Stewart family, but then we got more interest to do because Tuesday, the 23rd, we do the thing at the... the museum with Alan Sir Jr.
Absolutely.
And Scott Goody. I'm really looking forward to doing that.
And again, for those of you who are interested, and you'll be in town, 1070thefan.com, click the events page, and it's on the second page, I believe, of the events page, but you can buy your tickets there. They have all the information you need, and 1070thefan.com. Buy a couple tickets, come see Donald, come see Alan Unser Jr., come see Scott Goodyear. Should be a great time. All right, let's get back to the phones here.
Okay.
William from St. Louis, you're on with Donald Davidson.
Hi, William.
Hi, Donald. This is a little off topic, but okay. I used to remember that the United States Auto Club had a stock car division.
Yes, they did.
I know a lot of the 500 drivers drove in that.
Yep.
But they drove everything in those days. But could you comment a little bit about the stock car division? Like, I know it did fold at some point. How it started and so forth, and just the history, if you don't mind.
It started because it was a takeover when AAA, the contest board of the American Automobile Association. It's probably a longer answer than you wanted, but Bill France, who actually lived,
I've heard that name.
He was from Washington D.C. And at one point, he went to AAA and said, "Why don't you start a stock car division?" And they passed. They just wanted to do what I still call the championship division, and then sprints and midgets. And they weren't interested in stock. So then he goes down and gets NASCAR started. There was another association first, but then the NASCAR takes off. And so AAA thinks, well, golly, maybe we should, that thing's to be taken off. Maybe we should do that. So they started one in 1950. And
NASCAR was 49, I believe.
Yes, you are correct. And the AAA stock car circuit was a mix, but many of the Indianapolis 500 drivers would drive it, like Jack McGrath the real stars were Marshall Teague and Frank Rebel Monday, whose real name was Francisco Eduardo Menendez, but that doesn't matter. AAA announced in 1955 we're getting out of it, and USAC was formed. USAC then assumed all of the AAA responsibilities, and so the stock car division. And for the next several years, it would be a mix. There would be the stock car regulars. You would have a lot of people that when they would go to a certain area, local drivers would run. But then you would have, for the major events, you would have top Indianapolis 500 drivers. So Sam Hanks, Troy Ruttman, Jimmy Bryan, Pat Flaherty. They all ran stock cars, not on a regular basis, but you know, they would pick and choose. So a lot of the short track events they wouldn't go to, but golly, if they, you know, they went to Milwaukee, everybody was there. And Parnelli Jones, in no particular order here, Eddie Sachs won two races at Milwaukee for an outfit called Zico Lubate. Paul Goldsmith, Norm Nelson was a stock car regular. Don White was a stock car regular. Butch Hartman, Jack Bowser, those were among them. Les Snow, those were among the ones that were the stock car specialists. But Jerry Unser, Fred Lorenzen, Fred Lorenzen ever went to before he ever went to NASCAR, he was the USAC stock car champion in 1958 and 1959. And I think he was 22 when he won it in 58. Yeah. And I know I'm missing a bunch. Bobby Marshman, Roger Ward, and Dan Gurney occasionally, but I'm tripping over myself.
Let me ask you this, Donald. So at that time, NASCAR obviously was predominantly in the South. They were more of a region-based sport.
Yep.
You said USAC would go to Milwaukee. Were they more global or more across the country, I should say?
They ran Springfield, DuQuoin, Milwaukee several times a year when it was dirt and then after it was paved. And then for years they would run four. And then they ran the state fairgrounds. But they would also travel around. You know, they did Knoxville, Tennessee, a lot of places they only went to once. They would go out. You know, they'd go west. They ran Hanford a couple of times, but probably I would say for most of the years, Milwaukee was the basis of it.
Okay.
And as they would run four times a year. They ran Trenton a few times, Langhorne, both dirt and paved. And the answer to, whatever happened to it, that's a good question. Roger McCluskey, golly, ran, was a two-time stock car champion. So this is one of those where I'll go home, kicking myself for all of the people that I
have six or seven more names come up.
But it started to fade away a little bit. And then there was more and more... the whole stock car thing, both in NASCAR and USAC, it started off where the early stock cars were real, they were real cars, and then you would gut them a little bit and take the real seats out and then put fabricated seats in, and kept more and more was allowed, and there had to be roll bars and cage setups. And then it started to be that people would build stock cars. So instead of going to the junkyard, which some of the independents would do, and that was Sal Tavella, actually had Sal's Auto Sales, and he would actually race, in the early days, he'd race cars that came out of his own wrecking yard. And then, eventually then he got factory deals. But it would go from taking a basic car and stripping it down and racing it to building your own. So, if you wanted a stock car, you didn't go to the showroom and buy one. You went to Hutchison Pagan and they built one for you, or Holman and Moody or whatever it was. So then they started to... more and more sort of like trick cars started to come in, and I don't know.
That was around the 70s, wasn't it? Maybe 60s?
Yeah, more like the late 70s and then early 80s. And unfortunately, the thing as far as USAC was concerned just went away. So 1984 was the last year. But I know a lot of people didn't have kind things to say about the stock cars, but... personally, I when you go back and look at the lineups and the people that ran them, and the people still talk about the races out at the state fairgrounds, and all of the people that would run out there. I don't think I mentioned Foyt, did I? Foyt drove stock cars a lot. And
I know he won Daytona, so he would also do USAC as well.
He ran USAC, starting around 62.
Okay.
And then he was fairly much of a regular. I mean, he won the championship in 68. He was runner-up to Don White in 63. And then he and McCluskey were 1-2 to each other. I don't even know how to wind this up, except...
That's all right. I learned something today, so awesome.
I'd keep it going. I mean, in fact, I'll tell you what. How about this? The Yankee 300 in 1964, this would be 63 or 64, the Bill Strop Mercury team, okay, stock cars, Parnelli Jones, Roger Ward, Troy Ruttman, and Dan Gurney. How about that?
That's pretty impressive.
That's a pretty good tip. But they all dropped out, by the way. But maybe on a forthcoming night, I'll give some more thought to this.
Maybe around Brickyard time, we can certainly do that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, hey, we'll be right back. We have one final segment left, so we'll be right back here. Talking Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson, 107.5 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. I'm David Deering from Trackside and on the other side of the board normally for Talk of Gasoline Alley. Donald Davidson is here with us. Donald, you had some more drivers you wanted to mention from the USAC days.
Absolutely. All I need is a break. And I didn't look this up. I don't use a computer to do this.
I'm his witness. He does not use the computer on this.
All right. Al Unser, Bobby Unser, Mario Andretti, Lloyd Ruby, Billy Foster, Jim Herdebeest.
So a couple no names. Gotcha. Yep. That's awesome.
All stock car regulars.
There you go. Yep. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, this is me taking the opportunity to ask you a question.
Okay.
I think I've told you before, I think many listeners know, I grew up more as a NASCAR fan. I still am a NASCAR fan, love IndyCar as well. But as a kid, it was more NASCAR for me. And so the Indy 500 was kind of an afterthought. The first race I think I remember seeing was 97. And of course, that was the race that got rained out till Tuesday. I was in second grade, and my teacher, Mrs. Reed, thank you, wheeled in a television, and we watched the race all day in class towards the end of the year. So I always say that's the greatest day of school I ever had. I got to watch the Indianapolis 500. Are you kidding me? But could you talk about just the chaos that surrounded those 2 days? Because that's the last race we've had that's been rain delayed. That's been 20 years now.
Yeah, it went to Monday, and they started. They ran 15 laps,
and there was a wreck as well.
Well, yes, actually, at the start, there was the entire row got taken out. It was Alfonso Schiaffone, who was Felipe Schiaffone's cousin, and good heavens, I've done this well. Stefan Gregoire.
That sounds right.
And Kenny Breck. Kenny Breck was the other one driving for Gallus, and so the entire row got taken out. And then while they were clearing that up, Sam Schmidt hit the rail, and Alessandro Zampedri. I love that guy.
That's a great
name. What a great guy! Yeah,
I found a clip of Tom Carnegie saying Alessandro Zampedri. It just sounded awesome.
But what a delightful fellow he was, and one of the greatest laughs I ever remember. But I remember that. Stefan Gregoire, Alfonso Schiaffone and Kenny Breck went out, and then Sam Schmidt went out after that, and then the last one to go out was Alessandro Zampedri, and they still hadn't had the green yet. And so none of them had started, and when several cars are eliminated in an accident, you're ranked according to the number of laps that you completed. And if the several cars were on the same lap, then it's the one that was ahead on the previous lap. So if there haven't been any laps, you go back to the starting positions. And so it ended up, there was 35 starters, which is a whole other thing. I don't know if I even want to get into that. But they dropped, I'm not going to explain this very well, but each time somebody went out, before the start. They ended up with a worse finishing position than the people that had already gone out. So Alessandro Zampedri ended up 35th. I don't know if that means anything. So finally they get the thing going, and I think it was 15 laps in this rainfall. And so now what I'm trying to remember is Robbie Gordon, I know he was 29th and was doing the double. And I'm trying to think now whether the fact that whether the fact that he was out and then could go down to Charlotte and then wouldn't come back the next day because he was already out of the race, or whether in fact, because of the rainout on Sunday, he may have gone down to Charlotte and then done the 600 and then come back with the 500 that hadn't started yet. I don't remember how that went out.
That latter part, that sounds
that
right,
it?
Yeah.
All right, so then he goes to all the trouble to come back, and then he's out almost before the thing started.
Caught on fire.
I remember him bailing out in turn three, watching on
TV.
He
tried to get back in. I was watching the other day on YouTube. He tried to get back in the car after he had...
Well,
it
was a pure he wouldn't give up. He was a pure racer. I was always a Robbie Gordon fan. I'll not ashamed to admit that. I thought the guy was a pure racer. But anyway, so it came down to the late stages that with a sprint to the finish with Ari Leyendijk and Scott Goodyear, who was his own teammate. And they finished 1-2. And what was amazing about that, that was the first 1-2 finish for a team since leader cards in 1962 with Roger Ward and Len Sutton. Hmm. And at that time, Roger Penske had not had a 1-2 finish. And it was pretty ironic that that Roger Penske had not had a 1-2 finish in the 500, but Fred Treadway had. Ricky Treadway's dead. And Scott Goodyear and Ari were very good friends and friends to this day. And I don't know. What else do you want to say about it?
Poor Scott just coming up short once again.
But absolutely, yeah. But for a couple of twists of fate and a couple of eye blinks, I mean he wasn't that far. I mean I'm not going to really bring it up to him because I know it will hurt. But he wasn't that far off of being a three-time winner and came away with none. I mean he was so close to getting three wins.
That's awesome. Like I said, that really for me that was the first time I ever really got into the Indy 500 because of that rain delay. And it's still one of my favorite races just because I got to, see it as a kid. And so I thank you for humoring me on that. I appreciate that. Okay. We are out of time for tonight. Donald is back tomorrow. I am not. Joey, you're here tomorrow.
I am.
So we will be back tomorrow, 7 to 8, trackside, 8 to 9, Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. We will have the podcast up here shortly on 1070 The Fan as well as iTunes. You can find that there. Donald, thank you so much.
And thank you to everybody that calls in. I don't know that we do that enough. I really appreciate everybody's all the nice things that you say and that you listen and call in. Thank you. It
awesome.
Makes the show.
Well, thank you, guys. We'll have a great night. We will be back here tomorrow on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.